I guess I'll say 2 John. We'll be looking at both 2 and 3 John here. Well, I'm going to start with a quote from the New International Commentary on the New Testament that kind of brings the last week's sermon together with this week's sermon. Howard Marshall was the writer for 2 and 3 John, and he said, in 2 John verse 3, we see that the conventional blessings of grace, mercy, and peace, that's what we looked at last week, are accompanied by truth and love. We've already had one sermon focusing on truth, and I'll be working on that theme some more today. The revelation of God and Jesus takes place in the context of truth and love. Truth and love go together. And its effect is to lead believers into truth and love. And it's that truth and love that I want to focus on and in the practical application of discerning support of Christian ministry. There's a number of people that our congregation supports in ministry, from Benny and Max on campus to local ministries of mercy to Life Choice Ministries and Shepherd's Crossing to church planters overseas, the Vaughns in Central America and the Calls in South America. Trying to remember if there are others. We have, well, I guess we've also done invested in a helping ministry in Uganda with helping Christians financially there. Seems like there's another one I'm forgetting, but there are a number of ministries that we use your tithe money to support as a corporate church, and many ministries I know that are being supported by individuals in the church as well, with your own personal finances that you have and offerings. This is an important part of our faith. Our giving is a part of our worship of God, and so we have instructions from the last living apostle on how to do that in love and in truth. As he's written these two letters here to Gaius and to this lady whose name might have been Korea, but maybe not. We know God's command to love. We've already studied that in 1 John. It's the one, the old commandment that's renewed by the apostles. Paul said the same thing in 1 Thessalonians 4, encouraging them to increase more and more in their love for one another. And a practical command of love in the Bible is to practice hospitality and offer support to Christian ministers. Romans 12 gives it probably most succinctly and obviously commands us to share with God's people who are in need and practice hospitality. That's God's command to you. Share with those in need and practice hospitality. How do we do that? We're going to look at some facets of that today as we look at the examples of John and Gaius and this lady that he wrote 2 John to. There's a time, and as we look at the stories in these two letters from John, we see that we need to regulate our love with truth. Not every Tom, Dick, and Harry who claims to be doing Christian ministry is a legitimate minister. Diotrephes was not doing a good job as a minister. And in 2 John, we see warnings. Don't let some of these guys into your house. We need to sort out who is telling the truth before we support them. there's all kinds of weird ideas going around, unbiblical ideas. I picked up a book that I think was a college textbook from our from my studies at Covenant College, Scripture Twisting, 20 Ways the Cults Misread the Bible by James Sire. And he describes many situations where the truth has been twisted. A couple of examples. Swami Satchinananda, head of the Integral Yoga Institute, addressing a capacity crowd at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco, said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." This is what Jesus said. And then he said, "Yes, blessed are those who purify their consciousness, for they shall see themselves as God." How could the Swami turn a profound beatitude into a blasphemous equation of God and fallen man like that? But he's not alone. Sire goes through the Mormon Missionary Handbook, giving inside information about how, what Mormon missionaries are trained to, how they're trained to lead your conversation when they visit your house. And one of the biggies is to focus on James 1:5. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. But then soon they're teaching you to follow your feelings rather than the Bible. And they're telling you that God the Father and Jesus the Son, that God the Father has a glorified physical body, and that he's not the same as the Son. We had a guy in our church that grew up in the Christian Science cult, and the leader of that, Mary Baker Eddy, explained the Lord's Prayer once and said, "This is what it means: Our Father, Mother, God, who is all harmonious." Then you have Jehovah's Witnesses that quote John, that mistranslate John 1:1. The Word was with God, and the Word was a God, they said, because they said Jesus isn't the same as God the Father. There are all kinds of messed up ideas that are going around. Not all of them are worthy of our support. What I'd like to do is focus on some principles in 3 John that show an example of how to show Christian love through giving support to ministers, but regulate that with some principles from 2 John. Is that going to pop up if I... Yeah. Where there's warnings to use truth and discernment to regulate support of Christian ministries. So I'm going to start with the negative side first, the warnings in 2 John. And then we'll get into the encouragements and practical ideas for supporting ministries in 3 John. So 2 John, I'm going to start at verse 5, where John, the apostle says, "And now I ask, or I beseech you, lady, not as though writing to you a new command, but rather that which we've had from the beginning, namely that we should love one another. And this is love, that we should walk according to his commands. And this is the command, just as y'all heard from the beginning, that y'all should walk in it, because many erroneous men or deceivers have gone out into the world. Those who are not confessing Jesus Christ having come or coming in a physical body. This is, or the flesh, this is the erroneous one, the deceiver, and the antichrist." Here's a command to love. The support of ministers is motivated by love for God. And it is regulated by truth. The word truth was mentioned 5 times in the first 4 verses of 2 John. Why? Notice the word that starts verse 7. For, or because. That word's missing in the NIV, but the Greek word hati is there, even if the NIV omitted it. Matthew Henry commented on this, saying, he kind of rephrased it, you have need to maintain your love because there are destroyers of it in the world. Those who subvert the faith, destroy the love. These are people that it says have gone out into the world. The Greek phrase, or entered into the world, if you're reading the King James, that follows the majority of Greek manuscripts, rather than the oldest manuscripts. That phrase, gone out or entered into the world, is paralleled by the phrase later on in verse 9, launches forth or transgresses, goes too far, runs ahead, goes on ahead. Both phrases, the Greek word paints this picture of a person launching out of the door of his house, going forward into some kind of a ministry endeavor, bringing his ideas out into the public. And the problem is that there are all too many who are not going out there to spread the gospel of Jesus, but rather to promote some of their own ideas, alternate views about who Jesus is. And when those alternate views get promoted, they result in messed up views of how to relate to God. And it messes people's lives up. Some in John's day were teaching that God was too pure to mingle with humanity. And therefore Christ, the anointed one who's the only mediator between God and man, Christ couldn't have been both God and man, they said, because you can't mix God and man. They're too separate. One man named Cerinthus, who lived the same era that these letters were written, taught that Christ descended upon Jesus in the form of a dove at his baptism, and that Christ came from the power that is over all things, and that Christ is what proclaimed the unknown Father God, unknowable to human, physical world. And it was that Christ that accomplished miracles. But at the Last Supper, Christ separated away from Jesus again, and it was merely Jesus who suffered and was raised again. So this solves the problem of God getting too involved in the physical world. It keeps God from getting too dirty. Another teacher named Basilides taught that the Father sent his firstborn, which is the Christ, to liberate those who believe in him from the power of those who made the world. God didn't make the world. It was the intermediate spiritual beings that don't quite touch God that were able to get dirty enough to make the world. He appeared on earth as a man. He appeared and performed miracles. But he did not suffer. It was Simon of Cyrene who carried his cross that was the one that was crucified. Jesus just transformed Simon to look like him. That's an idea that later on was picked up by Muhammad, and he wrote that into the Quran. That's what Muslims believe, is that somebody was substituted for Jesus, and that's who died on the cross. How do we know who is a true teacher? Who is worthy of our support? John gives us something to look for. And interestingly, he brushes past most of the things that we Christians debate over. And he makes the doctrine of Christ the central issue to distinguish between true and false religion. John says, anyone who doesn't teach that Jesus is coming in flesh, that's a present tense coming in flesh, that is with physical body, is an error. Jesus took on flesh in order to be born of Mary, and he continues to have a physical, albeit glorified, and therefore in that way different from us, but still a body. That is the orthodox belief about Jesus. If Jesus was not God, then he couldn't do anything more for us than any other man could do for us. He can't save if he's not God. If he's not human, if he didn't come in flesh, then he can't unite God and man. There's no way for him to do that because he's not God. I mean, if he's not, or not human. And if as a human he didn't die, then we would have to die for our own sins. We'd have no Savior. These things are core to the Christian belief and to orthodoxy, right, teaching. We've already seen this issue before when we looked at when we studied 1 John chapter 4. He said, "Loved ones, many false prophets have come out into the world, and by this y'all know that the Spirit of God, every spirit which agrees that Jesus Christ has come in a physical body or in the flesh, came out of God. And every spirit which does not agree with Jesus Christ having come in a physical body is not out of God, and that's the spirit of the Antichrist." John continues in verse 8. "Therefore, because we need to watch out and look out and look out for ourselves in order that y'all might not lose what we worked for, what we wrought, what we accomplished. But instead, y'all may get back or receive or win a full reward. Everyone who launches forth while not remaining or abiding or continuing in the teaching of Christ, the doctrine of Christ, doesn't have God. And the one who remains in the teaching of Christ, this one has both the Father and the Son." This particular verse has some alternate readings among the Greek manuscripts. Some say we, some say you. It doesn't end up making a theological difference, though, whether the loss is viewed from the perspective of the Christian leader or from the perspective of the lay Christians. I'm not going to get into that this morning. But what is the doctrine or the teaching of Christ that a minister must remain in? John kind of alludes to it here and there, but doesn't have an actual list in his book. And a part of that is it's already in the gospel that he wrote. I like the summary that John Gill wrote back in the 1700s. He said, "The doctrine which is concerning his person as the Son of God and as truly God, and the union of the two natures, divine and human, in his one person, and concerning his office as the mediator, the surety, and the messenger of the covenant, and as the prophet, priest, and king of his church, concerning his incarnation, his obedience, his sufferings, his death, his resurrection from the dead and ascension into heaven, and session at God's right hand, and his intercession for his people, the second coming to judgment, concerning peace and pardon by his blood, atonement by his sacrifice, justification by his righteousness, and complete salvation by him." That is, this is the doctrine of Christ. This is the Messianic Talmud. There's a summary of what is explained in the Gospels of who Jesus is. A.T. Robertson, one of my favorite Greek scholars of the Greek New Testament, in his book Word Pictures in the New Testament, wrote about the false teachers who run ahead of the doctrine of Christ, applying him to our day in the modern and postmodern age. He said, "These Gnostics claim to be progressives, advanced thinkers, anxious to relegate Christ to the past and their onward march." That's very much what we're dealing with in doctrine today. All the neo-Orthodox doctrine, this is the idea, it's progress. Christ is in the past. This struggle always goes on among those who approach the study of Christ. Is Christ a landmark, or is he our goal and our pattern? If he's merely a landmark, we can put him to the side and make up our own ideas and goals. But if he is our goal and pattern, then that's it. There is nothing more to Christianity. but him. There's no room for humans and human ideas. One of the hallmarks of people that are pushing past Christ and coming up with new ideas is that they have some additional, well, let's see, did I have that? Yeah, there's the quote there from the New International Commentary. One of the key marks is that they say, well, there's this key that if we'll tell you what the key is to interpret the Bible with, or here is a book, the Doctrine and Covenants, or the Watchtower magazine, or some other book that can help you understand what the Bible says. And when you see that's a pretty good indicator of when people are starting to go off the rails, as if they say it's necessary to have this other thing here in order to understand the Bible really. So when someone comes to you and doesn't carry or bring orthodox teaching about Christ, don't receive him into the house. Don't speak to impart cheer to him. Don't bid him Godspeed. For the one who speaks to him to impart cheer is entering into partnership with his evil works, sharing in his evil works. The wording here, when someone comes to y'all, can be translated if, but in Greek, the tense of the verb and the choice of which word for if is used can be used to indicate whether the author thinks it's a true condition or a false condition or doesn't know. And in this case, he is indicating a true condition. If someone comes to y'all, and I assume they will, he's saying. The early church father Irenaeus was a disciple of John's disciple Polycarp. And he wrote down a story about the apostle John that Polycarp had told him from his experience with John himself. Said John was on the way to the bathhouse one day, and someone told him that Cerinthus was there in the bathhouse. And remember, Cerinthus was the guy who taught that the divine Christ was a different person from the human Jesus, and kind of came on him and left him. John got really upset. He turned around, stamped off back home, said, that bathhouse is going to fall down because there's an enemy of the truth in there. Gives you a little view of the other side of John that, you know, wanted to call down fire on the people and that didn't accept them into their town. Usually he talked about love, but there was that other side to him. But a false teacher shouldn't be received into the house of God to teach, shouldn't be received into your house for lodging, or to make it your house a base of operations for ministry in town. We have kind of a situation now that they didn't have 2,000 years ago. We have radio, TV, internet, a number of media where, instead of having to enter through your physical door of your house, a lot of ideas can enter through the airwaves or through wires into your house. We need to also be regulating those messages, we need to be gatekeepers, not letting into our home teaching that is false about God. Don't follow the podcasts or the YouTube channels or the radio messages or whatever that are not telling the truth about Christ. Don't even give them a chance to influence you and your children. Some of those things we might flirt with because they're entertaining. It can be entertaining to watch somebody who's just really kooky. But you know, we need to be careful about that. If it's not edifying, maybe it shouldn't be used for entertainment. We need to be careful about what we forward on, what we like, what we Google Plus or whatever it is you do, because that recommends it to other people. Your reputation is a valuable currency, and the things you recommend create a reputation about you. They create a reputation about God and about what you think truth is. We need to be very careful about what we are recommending to other people. There shouldn't even be any well wishes placed upon deceivers. The Greek text literally reads, "Do not speak joy to him." It's the same word that is used for joy or rejoicing in other places in the New Testament. He's not to be cheered on in his error through pleasant greetings or wishing him Godspeed. Practically, I'd say wouldn't be appropriate to say good luck or have a good day to a cult member who's come to your door seeking to proselytize you. You don't have to be ugly towards them. John doesn't teach us to persecute deceivers, but he does teach us to be careful, to be gatekeepers. You can disagree politely. You can even disagree with love in your heart and genuine concern for them. Some ideas I have, maybe you could say, take care as your way of saying goodbye. Or, you know, I'll be praying for God to reveal the truth to you. And that might, you know, a kind, genuinely loving way to say goodbye that's not encouraging their error. There may be people who have legitimate needs that come to your door and are terribly deceived and they don't need to be persecuted either. Did I have a quote from? Yeah, there's one from Matthew Henry. It says, "Doubtless such may be relieved in pressing necessities. If he's hungry, you can give him a sandwich." But they shouldn't be encouraged for ill service. Deniers of the faith are destroyers of souls. And it's supposed, deniers of the faith are destroyers of souls. We can't treat people who are opposed and actually fighting against the truth of Christ. We can't treat them with encouragement. And he brings up this other point too in the second half of his sentence. It's supposed that even ladies and I would add their children, because John includes the you as plural, lady and your children. And John assumes that this lady and her children have a good enough understanding of the affairs of religion to be able to tell who is a charlatan. He gives them a command: watch out for yourselves. So that raises a question for me: would your children be able to identify a false teacher? Would they be able to identify problems with cult teaching? If not, maybe it's time for a family devotional series on cults. This book presents it. Not so much in there are some books that go, you know, cult by cult, explaining what their set of teachings is, and that's a good way to approach it, I think. And the way that Sire approaches it in this book is more in terms of what are the kinds of ways in which they depart. And he teaches more a systematic way of treating your thinking about what the Bible teaches so that you recognize when somebody is departing from that. So this is not so much a catalog of cults, but those things are out there. He talks about misreading, worldview confusion, translation issues, using the Bible, using rhetorical forms that distort meaning, literature forms, how to use evidence, authority, things like that, that's how he categorizes it in his book. Albert Barnes, in his commentary on the Bible, said, "There are few arts more profound than that of leading people into error. Few that are studied more or with greater success. Every Christian, therefore, should be on his or her guard against such arts. And while he should, upon all subjects, be open to conviction, ready to yield his own opinions when convinced they're wrong, yet he should yield to truth, not to people, to argument, not to the influence of personal character of the professed religious teacher. We are in no way to become the patrons of error." This is about patronage, partnership, sharing, fellowship. Koinonia is a word that's used here. Partnership with his evil works. But there's a converse to all this, and that is enthusiastic patronage of faithful gospel ministry. And that's what I see in 3 John. So now we're going to jump into 3 John. It starts out, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I'm hoping for you to have good progress regarding all things and to be healthy, just as your soul is making good progress. For I was so excited when brothers came and gave a good reference about you being in the truth, just that you yourself are continuing to walk in truth. I have no source of joy greater than these things, namely when I hear of my children walking in the truth." Notice how prominent truth is in 3 John as well. I want to focus more on the positive example of practical love that's shown in support of fellow Christians here in 3 John. And I see 3 practical ways of loving support in 3 John. The first one is prayer. Second one is financial support. And the third one is hospitality or logistical support. I see prayer in these first few verses. He starts in verse 2. The verb is euhodao, which means literally a good road. It's used in 1 Corinthians 16:2 to indicate making a financial profit from business on a road trip. A good road trip. made money. The first person verb, eukomai, indicates that, I'm going to get my clicks in here, that indicates God has been thinking good. You see, both eukomai and eudontai start with the same first two letters, u, which means good. John says, I am thinking good, or I'm hoping for good, praying for good for you while we've been apart. By the way, would it be a curse or a blessing to you for someone to wish that you prosper physically as much as your soul prospers? Tend to that soul of yours. Anyway, we have an example to follow from the apostle. During the day, he's thinking about his friend. He's expressing to God hopes for blessing on his friend, and blessing in every way, not just spiritual life, but his health, his work, everything. There's a good example for us to pray for our buddies. Pray for those that God has called us to support in life and ministry. Prayer is strategic. Remember the story of Aaron and Hur at the Battle of Rephidim against the Amalekites? That's in Exodus 17. Joshua and the soldiers were out there swinging swords on the battlefield, But the reason they were winning was because Moses was up on the mountain praying for them. Moses would be praying for, dear God, help him take that guy down. Okay, God, please help him. Moses was praying for them, and he had his arms and his staff lifted in prayer. And when he got tired, he slacked off in praying, and the Israelite soldiers started getting killed. So Moses' brother and brother-in-law left the battle, came up on the hill with Moses, and physically held his arms up so that Moses could keep praying, and helped him pray through the rest of that battle. When Moses and Aaron and Hur came home that night, you think anybody said, what a bunch of wusses. Why weren't they out on the battlefield doing manly work? Why were they trying to escape from it all and be up on the hill talking to God? No. They weren't treated like deadbeats. Even though they weren't in the fight, they were the reason the soldiers were winning. Every soldier coming off the field owed their life to these prayer warriors. So thinking of the welfare of others and being concerned for their physical as well as their spiritual welfare and praying about it is a foundation for love, loving your fellow Christians. I would encourage you to, if you haven't already done this, to develop a list of pastors and missionaries to pray for regularly. Whether, that's just taking these prayer requests off the off of our missionary prayer letter board, or whether you subscribe to several missionaries so that you're staying up on how to pray for them, or something. Where you can regularly be praying for the spread of the gospel in certain ways, whatever ways, God leads you to be praying about. So prayer is strategic, but we don't stop with just praying. There's also financial support. In verse 5, 3 John verse 5, John continues, "Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever work you happen to do for the brothers." It's work. The word he used there is labor, laborious kind of work. You're doing this for the brothers, even this for outsiders, who themselves gave a good reference concerning your love before the church, and whom you will do well to send forward in a manner worthy of God, because they went abroad under the auspices of his name, taking nothing from the pagans. Therefore, as for our part, we ought to support such men in order that we may become co-workers in the truth. You see, it's, again, the motivation is love. Your love before the church is resulting in work that is supporting financially, I believe, as well as logistically, Christian ministers. After profiling the itinerant preacher, this outsider or stranger that Gaius had helped, John turns in verse 8 to the role of those not called to go out and preach, but those who stay and support. He uses that emphatic subject, we, changes the focus. As for us, what shall we do who stay home and do normal day-to-day things? What is our part to play? John says that the stayers are not useless. We're not mere consumers of spiritual benefits. We support, we receive, we show hospitality to those who go forth. And in so doing, we become co-laborers, as though we were side by side with them, doing work just as important. The verb he uses, send forward, as hupa lambanein, literally under receive or support, kind of pictures people getting under somebody and lifting him up, supporting him, so that he can do his ministry. This, by the way, speaks to a tension that I've seen over the years in missions, the full-time ministers versus the tent makers. And you occasionally see people in one camp criticizing the people in the other camp, people in the other camp criticizing the people there. What you're doing is unbiblical. What you're doing, the Bible shows us examples of both kinds, both full-time ministry as well as business as mission. Neither one is unbiblical. This is just a matter of wisdom to decide what's the most appropriate for a particular ministry situation. Don't get derailed by that. The verb in verse 8, here, these people that Gaius is supporting are full-timers. They're not working to provide for themselves. They're depending on support. The main verb in verse 8, we ought to be praying. We ought to be hosting. We ought to be financially supporting. We're going to sing after the sermon, I think, the hymn by Mary Thompson, O Zion, haste, give of thy sons to bear the message glorious. Give of thy wealth to speed them on their way. Pour out your soul for them in prayer victorious. And all you spend, Jesus will repay. Publish the glad tidings of Jesus and redemption and release. That's exactly what we see modeled in 3 John. John is saying to Gaius and to every one of us that have conscientiously partnered in the spread of the gospel, way to go. Laboring to help these folks is exactly what you ought to do. And that makes you every bit as much an important part of God's kingdom as any missionary or evangelist. Billy Graham isn't any more important than you. Keep up the good work. A little quote from, I forgot to click these things. A little quote from Matthew Henry. Those who are freely communicative of Christ's gospel should be assisted by those who are communicative of their purses. Albert Barnes talked a little bit about missions and concluded, if the churches value the gospel enough to send their brethren among the pagan to propagate the gospel, they should value it enough to minister to their needs while there. How easy it is to, once the missionary's launched off, you don't see them for a few years and you forget to pray for them. They're not really on your mind. But we need to keep in mind the missionaries that we've sent. Don't forget about them. We need to make sure their needs are continuing to be met. And the third way of showing support, motivated by love, in truth, is with hospitality and logistics. In 3 John verse 9, John said that he had written something to the church, but Diotrephes had apparently blackballed it, and he describes what Diotrephes, this wicked church leader, was doing. He would prevent people from practicing hospitality towards itinerant evangelists. And if someone did host an evangelist or listen to his preaching, then Diotrephes would kick him out of the church. And John identifies this as evil and says, mimic the good, not the evil. Chris read for us the instructions that Jesus gave us for his disciples for how to do itinerant ministry. You leave your home, you go to another town, find a public setting, preach the gospel, look for someone who's willing to host you in their home. Eat whatever they put in front of you, accept with gratitude the accommodations they offer you, stay with them until your ministry objective is completed, or until they kick you out. If you leave on good terms, the host will load you up with food, money for the trip, water, help you get to the next town, and you do it all over again. I think that's what John meant by send them forward on their way, on their journey in verse 6. And in this way, an itinerant preacher has all his needs met. All his food and clothing, shelter are met for as long as he's on the road, as long as he's got hosts like that. So staying in people's homes was part of Jesus' strategy for missionaries and evangelists, and the early church followed that pattern. We see multiple references to that in the first century document, the Didache, the teaching of the 12. But what if you couldn't find anybody willing to put you up for the night or to offer you supper? Diotrephes was shutting down competition for his leadership spot in the church by bad-mouthing every Christian minister that came through, refusing to let them speak in his church, kicking people out that supported them. And you might wonder how any church puts up with such a tyrant and its eldership, but people are easily deceived, and history's full of examples of cult leaders that control their little flock of people by using psychological and sociological pressure and keep the truth out, protect their own interests. People don't like their sin being exposed, and they'll insulate themselves from hearing the truth. The Greek scholar that I mentioned earlier, A.T. Robertson, wrote a whole article on Diotrephes for a Baptist magazine a century or so ago, and said that after publishing this article, he was just doing an exegesis on 3 John. But he said 25 deacons contacted the editor of the magazine afterwards, complaining that Robertson had personally attacked them. The truth hurt too much. They didn't like their sins being exposed by Robertson just saying what the Bible had to say about Diotrephes. Truth is important. Sometimes you're going to need to do a little bit of research before you know whether a ministry should be supported by you or not. As someone who has been on the receiving end of a lot of hospitality myself, I can tell you that practicing hospitality thoughtfully and generously and enthusiastically in a manner worthy of God not only impacts how a guest feels physically and is able to do ministry, but it also impacts how a missionary feels emotionally about his calling and about the message he has to share. Sure, we expect hardship and suffering, but on occasions where you're treated like royalty and there's delight in it, the host sends a message that, hey, your mission work that you're doing is important. It's significant. Keep up the good work. It's worth the lavish hospitality I'm offering you because you are representing the Lord Jesus, who's the King of Kings. That speaks real encouragement to the heart of a Christian worker. There are times when my family stayed with a host that obviously hadn't put much thought into hosting us. I remember one time, maybe more than one time, we were kind of thrown down into an unfinished basement and didn't really have much interaction with the host family at all. Another time I remember speaking at a church in Florida, and the travel was such that I needed financial help in order to make this work, and the honorarium check they gave me wasn't even enough for one night stay in a hotel. And I remember that night I was feeling pretty low. Other times we could tell that our hosts were putting real effort into supporting us. Some hosts gave out of their poverty. They didn't have a lot of food, but they gave us what they had. They didn't have many bedrooms to share, but you know, they gave us their beds. They slept on the couches, and there were, you know, and families like that, we fell in love with them and enjoyed the fellowship because they made us part of the family. There have been other places we've stayed where the host was wealthy and had a gift for hospitality, and those were delightful occasions to, you know, we've had private swimming pools and saunas and comfort foods, and you know, the host just sits at the table and listens and wants to know everything you have to say, and boy, that's just so encouraging when you have a great host like that. We should think of our guests as though they're Jesus himself. What if Jesus knocked on the door of your house? How would you exercise hospitality to him? Matthew Henry wrote in his commentary, Christians should consider not only what they must do, but what they may do. What they may most honorably and laudably do. And he quotes the proverb, the liberal mind deviseth liberal things. Christians should do even the common actions of life and of goodwill after a godly sort, as serving God therein and designing his glory. I encourage you to find ways to take hospitality to the next level as a way of showing the worthiness of God. We've been to places where we arrived late at night, and they had, you know, fresh cookies coming out of the oven. You know, a treat when they arrive. Take time off of work to listen and do stuff with your guests. Explain things that might not be obvious to them. We had a guy from Africa one time stay at our house, and one morning he came out and said, I need to find some rocks. And we said, well, what do you need rocks for? And he said, well, I need to wash my clothes. I said, oh, we've got a washing machine that does that. And so we showed him how to use it. He was just amazed. This was really cool. Your Wi-Fi, you know, help them get on there, and you know, whatever, you know, any quirks that your appliances have, you know, the bedroom, the temperature, the humidity, the amount of covers there. We were inspired one retreat we went to. They put Andy's mints on our pillows, and that was just an over the top touch there. Fresh flowers. And use your own creativity. God gives you creativity for that. How can you take your hospitality to the next level to show the worthiness of God? That's my conclusion for now. Maybe I'll find some other things in 2nd and 3rd John. I don't know. If not, I think I'll move on to Jude. But just pulling this together, these forms of supportive ministry, prayer, financial support, hospitality, God calls us to these things. We see examples for these things in the Bible. But to be Christian, they must be motivated by love, not to impress the guest, but because I love God and I want to show how worthy God is of everything I've got. That's why I'll pray. That's why I'll financially support. That's why I'll host. John repeatedly speaks of his love for Gaius, calls him beloved. To love in truth rather than to love in order to receive some benefit in return. That's the essence of the love which characterizes God. Jesus loved us just because he wanted to, not because he gets some benefit in return. Showing hospitality to people from afar who have no way to pay you back and whom you may never see again gives the opportunity to practice unselfish love. But all the same, the generosity of hospitality and support must be tempered by truth. We need to know the truth about who we're hosting. Do they have the character of a freeloader or a charlatan? or as a genuine Christian on mission with God. What a joy it is when you find someone who is on mission with God, and you support them, become a fellow laborer with them, and they appreciate it, and they reflect it back and say, thank you so much. I couldn't do this without you. That is a joy, to experience that kind of partnership in Christian service.